A red banner of flame, shaped like a child's hand, reached up and snatched at it. Harper let go with a soft cry and jumped off the running board. Her legs felt watery and loose beneath her. Renee put a hand on her elbow to steady her.
"I've heard of tongues of flame," Renee said mildly, "but not arms."
Harper shook her head, couldn't find her voice. The fireman slammed the driver's side door and put the fire engine into reverse. The tow line was yanked taut with a snap. The fire truck's tires spun, smoked, found purchase, and dragged the rear of the 18-wheeler aside with a shriek of metal. When the big rig was out of the way, Harper could see up the road for the first time. Less than 20 feet beyond the semi, a crater the size of a compact car had swallowed one lane. Not far after that was another crater, but in the passing lane. Half a mile down the highway, Harper saw an enormous tree across the interstate, a vast larch that had somehow been crystallized by fire. It looked as if it were made of burnt sugar. The road was long and straight, and heat distortion climbed off the softened, buckled ruin of the blacktop. "We'll have to take it slow from here on out," the fireman said. He had that one wrong.
16.
The fireman steered the truck around the great crumbled pits in the road, rolled along to the fallen larch, and stopped again. Harper and the others didn't even bother riding with him in the truck, but followed along on foot. The sky hazed over as if it was going to rain, only it wasn't going to rain, and the color of the clouds was wrong. Those clouds were salmon-colored, as if lit by sunset, and never mind, it was midday. The air had the staticky feel that sometimes warned of thunderheads. The pressure tickled Harper's eardrums unpleasantly. The fireman strapped the tow to the downed tree and ran the truck back. There was a loud crack. He cursed artistically.
"Did you hear what he said? No woman could really do that," Renee said. "It's anatomically impossible."
He jumped down from behind the wheel. The tow line had yanked a 10-foot branch right off the tree.
"You have to get the chain around the trunk," Allie said, "or it'll break into pieces."
Nick sat on the rear bumper of the fire truck with Renee and Harper, while Allie and the fireman ran the tow around the center mass of the tree.
"Let's play a game," Renee said. 20 questions. Who wants to go first?"
Harper translated. Nick replied in sign.
"He wants to know if it's animal, vegetable, or mineral."
"Mineral, sort of. Oh, boy, we're off to a bad start."
They went back and forth, Harper serving as their conversational go-between.
"Is it yellow?" Harper asked for him.
"Yes, but also sort of orange.
Now he wants to know if it's bigger than a car."
"Yes, much bigger."
Nick spoke rapidly with his hands.
"He says it's a truck," Harper said.
"No," Renee said cheerfully.
Nick hopped off the rear bumper, his hands flying, arms waving. "He says it's a big orange truck," Harper said.
"No," Renee told her again, frowning. "Tell him no. He's wasting his questions."
But by then Harper was off the fender herself, staring back down the interstate.
"We have to go," she said.
Nick was already running toward the front of the truck. Harper jogged after him, shouting the whole way, her voice rising from a yell to something that wavered at the ragged edge of a scream.
"John, we have to go! We have to go! Right now!"
John was half in the cab, one hand on the steering wheel and one foot on the running board. He leaned out of the fire engine to shout instructions to Allie, who straddled the larch, adjusting the tow line around the trunk. When he heard Harper hollering, he glanced around, then narrowed his eyes and squinted past her. On the far rise, a mile away, an orange truck winked in the sun. Harper could distantly hear the building roar of its engine as the freightliner barreled toward them.
"Allie, get off the tree!" John shouted.
Allie cupped a hand to her ear and shook her head.
"Can't hear you!"
Harper could barely hear John herself over the fire truck's idling engine. Harper jumped up on the running board beside the fireman and rang the brass bell, hard and loud as she could. Allie read Harper's face, leapt off the tree, and came running.
"In the truck! In the truck!" John shouted. "Quick now! I need to back up!"
Allie snatched Nick off the ground, arms around his thighs,
lifted him off the road, and hustled for the rear of the fire truck. He gave them perhaps 10 seconds to climb in, and then he threw the fire truck into reverse, gunned the engine. The tree caught the truck and anchored it in place. The tire spun. Harper stood on the running board, clutching the open door with one hand and John's arm with the other. Jacob's freightliner was less than a mile away, sun glaring bleakly off the splintered windshield. Harper could hear the thin whine as it accelerated. John applied more pressure and the tree rocked, turned over, and began to slide through the ash. Branches snapped and broke, littering the road. A half mile away, Jacob's snow-wing plow clipped the back end of the Walmart truck and tore the trailer to shreds, launched it up and out of his way with a metallic crash. The tree caught on a fissure in the road, wouldn't budge. John cursed. He put the truck in drive, rolled forward 10 feet, and slammed it into reverse again. He ran straight back, tires shrieking. Harper held on, clenching her teeth, her pulse sick and fast, bracing herself for the jolt. The larch tree jounced up in the air and crashed back down, boughs shattering and flying, rolling far enough to one side to clear a lane. "I'll unhook us," Harper said. She jumped down and ran around to the front of the truck. "Hurry, Willows," the fireman called to her. The sound of the freightliner rose to a bellowing roar. "Get in! Get in!" Harper slipped the tow line free from the front hitch and ran for the passenger side. "Go!" she yelled, grabbing the passenger side door and stepping onto the running board. The fire truck lumbered forward. Thick branches cracked and shattered under the tires. By the time Harper pulled herself part of the way up into the passenger seat, he was doing nearly 20 miles per hour. He swung around the larch, building speed slowly but surely on a straight stretch of road that climbed to the top of a little rise. The snow-wing plow struck the tree. The larch wasn't swatted clear so much as pulverized, branches shattering in a cloud of gray powder and black fragments. The freightliner screamed. Harper felt she was hearing Jacob's true voice for the first time. She had one knee up on the passenger seat when the freightliner slammed into the rear of the truck. The impact dropped her. Her legs fell back out the open door, hung over the road. She got one arm through the open passenger side window, hanging onto the door. Her other hand grabbed the seat. "Hop!" the fireman yelled. "Oh, God, Hop! Get in! Get in!" "Faster!" she told him. "Don't you dare slow down, Rookwood!" She kicked her feet but couldn't seem to pull herself up into the seat. Too much of her was hanging out the passenger side door, and her center of gravity was too low, all her mass and weight dangling over the road. Harper turned her head to see where the freightliner was, and in the same moment Jacob hit them again. Harper saw him then, behind the wheel, Jacob's starved, bristly, scarred face. He did not smile or look angry. His head rolled on his neck as if he were dosed up with some heavy anesthetic. "Will you, for God's sake, get in the truck?" the fireman said. He had one hand on the wheel but wasn't looking out the windshield anymore. He had stretched all the way across the passenger seat to grab for her, extending his right hand with its taped wrist. She swatted wildly for his arm, caught his fingers. He hauled at her, straining against the slipstream that wanted to vacuum her right out of the front seat. Her feet kicked in the air, and then her knee found the footwell, and she was in the cab. The fire truck had been drifting while he dragged her up. They clipped a baked Honda Civic parked on the left-hand margin of the interstate. The Honda's back end flipped into the air as if a mine had exploded under the rear tires. They sped past it, left it behind. The Honda came down across the turnpike behind them with a rattling thud. The snowplow hit it an instant later and knocked it aside with a shriek, a sound of almost human fury mingled with the crunch of imploding glass. She scrambled into her seat, the passenger door still open and waving back and forth. Harper grabbed the black leather strap hanging above the door and stuck her head out, looking back. "The fuck are you?" the fireman asked. She was full of song. A song of outrage and grief that had no words and no melody, and her hand ignited like a rag soaked in gasoline when touched with a match. Blue flame roared from it, and she threw it, threw a softball of fire. It struck the windshield of the freightliner, sprayed across the glass in a liquid fan of flame, and went out. Harper threw fire again and again. A blast of blue flame snapped off the passenger side mirror on the plow. A bolt struck the plow itself, briefly turning the snow wing into a shallow trough filled with crackling white flame. The fourth time she cast flame, it hooked like a curveball or a knuckler and struck the front passenger side tire. The wheel became a blazing hoop. "Can you blind him?" the fireman asked. "What?" Harper asked. "Blind him. Just blind him for 10 seconds. Now, if you please. And for God's sake, put your seatbelt on." The tendon stood out in John's neck. His lips were drawn back in an appalled grimace. They were rushing up a hill toward some kind of overpass. The front of the fire truck thwacked aside a diamond-shaped orange sign, a warning. Harper didn't have time to see what it said before the fireman sent it spinning. Harper didn't bother with the belt. She couldn't buckle in and still lean far enough out the door to throw flame directly at Jacob behind the steering wheel. She stuck her head into the boiling afternoon air and looked at the Freightliner. Jacob stared back through his cobwebbed windshield, the cracks running from a single bullet hole just to the right of where he sat. Harper thought Jamie Close had come very close to shooting him through a lung that night in the church tower. She took a deep breath and threw a fistful of fire. It hit the windshield at the bullet hole. Flame squirted outward, following the cracks, making a web of flame. A little fire spattered through the hole, and Jacob flinched, turned his head away. Harper thought for a moment he shut his eyes. Harper turned to see what lay ahead and saw the overpass was gone. "Bridge out," that was what the orange safety sign had said. The overpass had collapsed in the center, leaving a chasm 30 feet across, rebar sticking out of shattered concrete. At the last instant it came to her that she still didn't have her seatbelt on. John hammered his foot onto the brake and wrenched the wheel to the side, veering suddenly and sharply away from the drop. It was almost too much, too hard. The fire truck slewed sideways, tires whining, a high, ragged whine of blistering rubber. Blue smoke poured from the undercarriage. Harper could feel how the truck wanted to topple over. John had his whole body across the steering wheel, pulling against it. The truck slid sideways, shuddering with the force of a jackhammer. "I am going to miscarry," Harper thought. The Freightliner clipped the rear end in passing. The fire engine spun like a revolving door. For an instant they were staring back the way they had come, and still sliding backward. Centrifugal force slung Harper against her door. If she had not closed it the moment before, she would have been hurled out. The steering wheel whirred so quickly in the fireman's hands that he let go of it with a cry of pain. They were looking back in the direction of New Hampshire, still skating over the blacktop. So Harper didn't see when the Freightliner blew past them and over the drop, fell 30 feet, and hit the road below with a concussive crash that seemed to shake the world. It felt as if a bomb had gone off beneath them. She still felt a little as if they were spinning, even after the fire truck stopped moving. She looked at John. He stared back at her with wide, bewildered eyes. He moved his lips. She believed he was saying her name, but wasn't sure, couldn't hear over the drone in her ears. Nick was right. Reading lips was hard. He gestured with his hands, a little shooing motion. "Get out." He was fighting with his seatbelt. She nodded, stepped down through the open door on trembling legs, climbed onto the running board, then lowered herself to the road. She let go of the door and looked toward the gap in the overpass and felt all the wind go out of her. The back half of the fire engine hung over the edge of the chasm. It was tipping. As Harper watched, it seesawed back, the front tires rising into the air. Harper just had time to catch her breath. She was getting ready to scream John's name when the fire truck tilted over the side, into the gap, and took the fireman with it. 17. Harper ran to the edge of the missing overpass and stared down past twisted rebar and crumbled concrete. The fire engine had dropped straight back and turned onto its passenger side. She had the wrong angle, couldn't see into the cab, couldn't see John. The Freightliner was upside down. Something was burning down there. Harper could smell the stink of scorched rubber. It was only shock that held her where she was, a great tingling throb of emotion that she could feel in her nerve endings, in her fingertips. "All dead," she thought. "All dead, all dead." John and Nick and Allie and Renee and John and Nick and Allie and Renee and John and Nick and Allie and Renee. Her throat hurt and she realized she was screaming, had been screaming for almost a full minute, and she made herself be quiet. The thing to do was to get down there and see what she could do. She turned and almost ran right into Allie. Her face was aglow with sweat and she was gasping from her run. "Where did you come from?" Harper asked. "How did you get out?" Harper gazed blankly past her. Half a mile away, she saw Nick trotting along the margin of the road, leading Renee by the hand. "Never got in," Allie said. "Never had a chance. Renee shoved us into a ditch as soon as I reached the back end of the truck with Nick. The next thing I knew, you and John were driving off without us. Where's John? Where?" As Allie spoke, she was creeping past Harper to look over the drop. Harper grabbed her arm and drew her away before she could reach the edge. "Don't look. I don't want Nick to see, and I don't want you to see either. You stay here and don't come unless I call for you." Harper wanted to run, but her days of running had ended several weeks before. She did a funny sort of pregnant lady trot, holding her stomach. She climbed over a guardrail and slid down the bank on her big pregnant rump, grabbing fistfuls of brush to slow her descent. The road below was a divided highway, running east and west. The fire truck lay across the eastbound lanes. A lake of fire sputtered and gushed across the blacktop, and Harper thought wildly, "Gasoline! It's spilling, burning gasoline! It's going to explode!" She skipped over the flames and reached the front of the engine. She could see in through the windshield. It was smashed and sagging inward from the frame. John hung sideways, still buckled in his seat, his head on his right shoulder, and blood dripping from under his hairline and nose. But not dead. Harper could see the rise and fall of his chest. What she couldn't see was how to get him out. She was too pregnant to climb up to the driver's side door, which currently faced the sky. She couldn't smash in what was left of the windshield without a tool, and was afraid to spray him with broken glass. A ladder, Harper thought. Not the big ladder mounted to the roof, but one of the smaller ones packed into the rear cabinets. She hopped back over that long ribbon of fire. What exactly was burning? It didn't smell like gasoline. And made her way to the rear of the truck. Compartments all along the fire engine had been torn open, and she stepped carefully through a Lincoln log tangle of axe handles and crowbars. She was in a hurry and almost stepped on the cat, recoiled when it yowled at her in alarm. Harper caught herself, took a step back. Mr. Truffles gazed up at her, his jade-colored eyes glazed with shock, his fur ruffled up. Renee had got all of them away from the truck except for him, it seemed. "Oh, you," Harper said, crouching down and reaching toward him. "My God, how did you survive? I wonder how many of your 9 lives you just used up." "All of them," Jacob said, and his shovel swiped down through the smoke and struck the cat like a croquet mallet impacting the ball. Mr. Truffaut flew, broken-necked and dead, through the air and into the brush. Harper screamed and went straight back, falling on her butt. Jacob lifted the shovel over his head in both hands. She pushed herself back with her heels, and the blade of the shovel came down in the soft blacktop between her feet. She dragged herself away from him, pulling herself along on her bottom, through broken glass and loose rock. He had to wiggle the handle of the shovel back and forth to loosen the blade before he could step forward, and she had time to get a good look at him. His right hand was blackened and burned to the texture of fried chicken skin. The flesh had fissured to show ripe pink meat beneath, glistening with pus. The right side of his face was charred, too, and the hair on that side of his head was still smoking. An old black burn in the shape of a man's hand mottled the loose flesh of his throat. He came forward, flat-footed and slow, with nothing of his former dancing grace. When he spoke, his voice was thick and slurred. His lips had fused together at the right corner of his mouth. "I was right when I said you made me sick, baby girl," he said. "It's true you didn't contaminate me with dragon scale, but you made me sick in a different way. A worse way. Being around you is like having a low-grade fever. A woman like you is a kind of infection.
You were living off me like a bacteria. You don't know how badly I want to be well, to be cured of you.
He took another swipe, but she pushed back on her heels. The shovel blade sliced through the haze, dragging silky shreds of smoke behind it.
I thought you would be my muse once, he said, and laughed a strange, discordant sound. I thought you'd inspire me. Well, in the end, you sure did. In the end, you led me to my real calling, putting out fires. I'm such a good little fireman. I put them out before they even start. You see? In a way, you were my muse.
She was no more a muse than he had ever been a writer, Harper thought. And she wasn't sorry, not for that. Jacob could only see her in terms of blame or inspiration, but either way it reduced her to a kind of fuel. Either way, she had always just been something for him to burn up.
Is your boyfriend still alive? Jacob asked, nodding back toward the truck. I want him to be alive. I want to slice off your head and put it in his lap before I kill him. I want him to look into your face one last time and say your name. I want him to know that he couldn't keep what he took away from me.
In her mind, Harper began to sing without words. Her left hand sputtered, smoked, glowed, and began to flicker with firelight. She lifted it, and Jacob smashed it with the shovel, and the flame went out. Harper shouted at the pain of it.
Did he teach you a little trick? Jacob asked. Besides how to suck his cock? Too bad he didn't teach you not to play with fire. A woman your age ought to know how that ends, baby girl. Little girls who play with fire get burnt in the end. They get burnt all up gone.
But Harper wasn't listening. Harper was looking past him. She felt a sick rush of blood to her heart and was having trouble finding her breath.
Pay attention to me, Jacob said.
He put the point of the shovel under her chin and used it to lift her head, forcing her to look up into his eyes.
I'm talking to you, baby girl. Did you even hear what I just said? Did you listen to me at all? Little girls shouldn't play with fire. That's how people get hurt.
Yes, Harper whispered. You're right. I'm so sorry, Jacob. He narrowed his eyes in a question, then started to turn his head. By then, the woman of flame had crossed half the distance between him and the truck. She was Jacob's very height, and her hair flowed for yards behind her, yellow and red. She was nude, in a sense, although her shifting, wavering shape seemed more like a form made out of crimson silks. Her eyes alone burned hot blue, like the flame of a blowtorch. She left footprints behind her, footprints of red flame.
Mom, Allie said from 30 feet away.
She had made her way down the incline after all, and stood there holding Nick's hand. Her voice was small and bewildered.
The woman of fire threw a hatchet of flame. It wasn't there until the instant she drew back her hand. It struck Jacob in the face and he screamed, flame splattering across his features, up into his hair. She cocked back her hand and a new hatchet of fire appeared in it, leaping into her fist out of nowhere. She threw again, coming toward him. The second hatchet struck him in the chest and the filthy, oil-stained ruin of his white T-shirt ignited. He took a staggering step toward her, but he couldn't see through the black smoke engulfing his head. She stepped aside like a bullfighter. He stumbled and fell to one knee. She sank down beside him and took him gently into her blazing arms.
18. Allie crouched at the bottom of the embankment with Nick in her arms. She clutched her brother's face to her chest and buried her own head in his shoulder, the pair of them squeezed together like the two halves of a walnut. The flame that had once been a woman rose from the black and smoking corpse of Jacob Grayson. She left her kill and walked toward the children. Her heels left bubbling footprints, liquefying the asphalt beneath them. When she was 10 feet from Nick and Allie, she lowered herself with an exquisite grace, crossing her ankles and sinking down to sit cross-legged. Allie lifted her head and peered at her, then squeezed Nick's shoulder to let him know it was okay to look. Her golden hair flowed and crackled. The road beneath her was melting, turning to a puddle of tar. Nick spoke with his hands. He said, "Mom?" She nodded and said, "I was once," moving her hands in swirls of fire. "Most of who I was has burned away." "I've missed you," he said, and Allie fingerspelled. "Me too. So much." Sarah nodded again. The top of her head was an open chalice of flame. Whatever she was burning to stay with them, the air and a million whirling grains of spore, she was using it up fast now, cooling out, cooling off. When the breeze gusted, she rippled like a reflection in unsettled waters. "It was all my fault," Nick told her with his hands. "You don't blame a match for starting a fire," the Sarah flame said. "You blame the person who strikes it. You were just a match."
"You'd still be with us if I hadn't tried to teach you how to cast fire."
With her hands, she said, "I am still with you." With gestures, she said, "I am always with you. Love never burns away. It just keeps on and on." They were crying again. Perhaps she wept as well. Flame dripped from her face and spattered in the road. The children spoke to her with their hands, and she nodded and replied in kind. But Harper turned away from them and did not see the end of their conversation. What they said to each other was for them alone. Harper came unsteadily to her feet and looked around. Jacob's charred and withered corpse poured filthy black smoke. Harper walked to the rear of the wreck and dug through dirty coils of hose. She excavated a fire blanket and flapped it over Jacob's head and shoulder, then backed away, waving the smoke away from her face. It smelled like a trash fire. She bumped into someone standing behind her. Renee put a steadying hand on her shoulder. Renee had made her way down the embankment to join them at last. "Have you seen the cat?" Renee asked, her voice strained and stunned.
He didn't make it, Renee," Harper said. "He was thrown clear in the accident. I'm sorry."
"Oh," Renee said and blinked. "What about—"
"John is alive, but hurt. I need help to get him out of the truck."
"Yes, of course."
Renee looked back at Allie and Nick and the burning woman.
"That? What is that?"
"She came with John," Harper explained.
"She's—"
Renee began, then swallowed, licked her lips, tried again.
"She's—"
Her voice caught in her throat again.
"An old flame," Harper said.
19. Renee wedged a crowbar under one corner of the windshield and pried it free. It flopped into the road all in one piece, a jingling blanket of blue safety glass with a thousand fissures in it, impossibly holding together. Harper and Renee squeezed into the cab together and stood below John, who hung suspended above them, strapped in by his seatbelt. A drop of blood fell into Harper's right eye, and for a moment she was seeing the world through red-stained glass. The two of them did their best to get him down to the ground without jostling him, but when his right foot struck the blacktop, his eyes flew open and he cried out in a thin voice. They dragged him from the wreck of the truck. Renee went to get something to put under his head and came back with the portable mother, which served well enough as a pillow.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, my leg. It's bad, isn't it? I can't look."
Harper moved her hands over his thigh, feeling the break in his femur through the thick rubber of his fireman pants. She didn't think it had punched through the skin and was certain it hadn't nicked a major artery. If it had, he wouldn't be asking her about his leg. He'd be unconscious from blood loss or dead.
"I can deal with it. I'll have to set it and splint it, and without painkillers, that's going to hurt."
She probed his chest. Once he gasped and shut his eyes and pressed his head hard back into the carpet bag beneath it.
"I'm more worried about the ribs. They're broken again. I'll have to scratch around, see what I have to set your leg." She felt a heat at her back and knew who was standing behind her. "There's someone here to keep you company while I'm rummaging around." She kissed him on the cheek, rose, and stepped aside. Sarah stood blazing over him. She lowered herself to one knee and looked into his face, and Harper thought she was smiling. It was hard to tell. Her face was little more than rags of flame. When Sarah had first appeared, she had been a shroud of white fire with a core of almost blinding heat at her very center. Now, though, her dominant hue was a dull, deep red, and she had diminished to childlike proportions, was about the size of Nick.
"Oh, Sarah. Oh, look at you," John said. "Just hold on. We'll collect up some wood. We'll keep you going."
He lifted his hands, trying to say it in gestures. She shook her head. Harper was sure now she was smiling. The Lady of Fire lifted her chin, the breeze gently blowing the last tatters of her hair, and she seemed to stare right into Harper. To stare at her in the dreamy way Harper herself had often stared into moving flames. At the last, Harper thought Sarah winked at her. When she went out, it happened all at once. The girl of flame collapsed into herself in a rattling drizzle of cinders. 1,000 green sparks whirled up into the afternoon. Harper raised one hand to protect her eyes and was stung all over, gently stung, as they rained into her, touching her bare arms and brow and neck and cheeks. She flinched, but the light prickling was gone in a moment. She wiped at her cheeks and came away with a palm of smeared ash. Harper rubbed it between thumb and finger, watching the pale grime drift away on the light breeze, thinking of what they said at funerals, the bit about ashes to ashes, which went along with something about the certainty of resurrection. 20. John's eyes were scared, his face pebbled with sweat and soot. His pants were off. The right thigh was black and bloated, twice as thick as his left. Renee's chubby palms rested below the break, while Harper's gripped the leg just above it. "Are you ready?" Harper asked. John gave her a tight, frightened nod. "Let's get this Dark Ages medical procedure over with." Allie was standing 30 feet away, but when the fireman began to scream, she turned her back on them and clapped her hands over her ears. The bone made a grinding sound as the two broken parts settled back together, a noise that made Harper think of someone dragging a rock across a chalkboard. 21. Allie was the one who figured out how to make a travois by folding blankets across a segment of fire ladder. They lashed him down to it, running bungee lines across his shins and hip bones. A final cord went around his forehead. Those were the only places they could put the cables without crossing a broken bone. He was by then unconscious but restless, blowing air from his lips and trying to shake his head. He looked very old, Harper thought, his cheeks and temples sunken, his brow creased. He also had a flustered, dim-witted expression that made her heart sick. Renee disappeared for a while, but when she returned, she had a road map of New England, which she had discovered in the glove compartment of Jacob's freightliner. Harper sat with it across her knees for a while, then told them it was 200 miles to Machias. "If we set a pace of 20 miles a day," Harper said, "we can be there in a little over a week." Harper waited for someone to ask if she was kidding. Instead, Alec crouched, took the ends of the homemade travois, and stood. John's head rose into the air until it was about level with the small of her back. Allie's face was a grim, stoic mask.
"Better get going, then," Allie said. "If we start right now, we can make 10 miles before we lose the light. I don't see any good reason to waste the day. Do you?"
She glared around at them, as if she expected a challenge. She didn't get one.
10 days on your feet," Renee mused. She looked at Harper's distended belly. "When's the due date?"
Harper showed a tight smile. "Plenty of time." She had lost track,
but was pretty sure it was down to less than 2 weeks. Renee salvaged a bag of groceries from the wreck, and Harper picked the portable mother out of the road. They had struggled their way back up the slope to I-95 before Harper noticed Nick was carrying a fire axe. He was a practical child. Where it wasn't shattered, the road was blanketed with ash. There was nothing to see all the way to the horizon, except cinder-colored hills and the charred spears of the pines. A few hours before dusk, they reached a place where the interstate caved away into what had once been a creek. The water was choked with ash, had become a magnesium-colored sludge. A 79 Mercury floated down it, up to its headlights, looking like a giant robot crocodile patrolling a toxic canal. Allie set the travois down by the side of the road. "I'll go upstream, see if there's another way across." "I don't like the idea of you taking off alone," Harper said. "We don't know who might be out there. I can't lose one more person I love, Allie." It blindsided Allie, hearing Harper tell her she loved her. She looked around at Harper with an expression of shock and pleasure and embarrassment that made her seem much younger than she was. 12, not 17. "I'm coming back," Allie said. "Promise. Besides..." She tugged the fire axe out of Nick's hands. "My mom isn't the only one who knows how to sling one of these around." She went down the steep slope at the side of the road, wickering the blade back and forth to clear her way through the shoulder-high grass. She was back just as it turned twilight, the sky curdling a sickly shade of yellow. When Harper asked if she had found anything, she only wearily wagged her head and didn't speak. They camped on the banks of the river, under the overhang of the collapsed bridge. In the night, the firemen began to rave. "Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim chiride, find me some water, for I burn up inside. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim chirid. If I was on fire, would you piss on my head?" "Shh," Harper told him, one hand across his waist, clasping herself to him to keep him warm. The day had been sullen and hot, but after dark the air was so cold and sharp they might have been on an exposed mountain ridge. His face was drenched with an icy, sick sweat, yet he kept grabbing the collar of his shirt and pulling at it, as if he were roasting. "Shh, try and sleep." His eyelids fluttered, and he gave her a wild, distracted look. "Is Jacob still after us?" "No, he's all gone." "I thought I heard his truck. I thought I heard him coming." "No, my love." He patted her hand and nodded, relieved, and slept again for a while. 22. They spent most of the next morning doubling back, retracing their steps to an off-ramp, which led them down past the napalmed ruin of a pizza hut. The fireman slept most of the way. When he did wake, his eyes were stunned and uncomprehending. He didn't have much to say, at first, and sometimes it was necessary to ask him a question a few times before he'd hear it. His replies, however, were coherent and sensible. Yes, he would like some water. Yes, his leg hurt, but it was all right. He was managing. His chest didn't hurt so much, but it felt heavy. It felt tight. He asked Allie several times to loosen the strap across his chest. At first she told him there wasn't a strap across his chest, but the third time he asked, she said, "Sure, no problem," and he thanked her and dropped the subject. Only once did the fireman do anything particularly troubling. He moved his hands, speaking to Nick. Nick's reply was easy to understand. He shook his head, "No." Then he hurried to catch up to Harper and walked along beside her, where he could avoid eye contact with the fireman. "What did he say?" Harper asked. "He said he was pretty sure the truck was still behind us. The big plow. I told him it wasn't, but he said he could hear it. He said it was still coming, and if it got any closer, we'd have to leave him." "He's sick. Don't worry. He's mixed up." "I know," Nick said. "Your sign language is getting pretty good." Harper was going to say, "Maybe I'll teach my son." And then she remembered if everything went according to plan, she would never know her own son. she would be giving him up to someone healthy. She put her hands in the pockets of her hoodie and left them there, all done talking for a while. They stopped for lunch in an improbable stand of birch trees, located in a center island between two lanes of a country highway. The hills to either side of the road were crowded with blackened trees, but in the small teardrop-shaped island, there was a place that had been untouched by fire, a zone of green, ferny cool. They drank bottled water and ate pretzels. At some point, a soft, dry hail began to spatter down around them, striking their shoulders and the trees, the leaves, and the ferns. Harper found a ladybug crawling on the back of her hand and another on her wrist. She brushed a hand through her hair and swept half a dozen ladybugs into the grass. When she lifted her head, she could see hundreds of them, crawling on the trunks of the trees or opening their shells to glide on the breeze. No, thousands. Ladybugs soared on the updrafts, hundreds of feet above, a slow, floating storm of them. Renee stood up wearing hundreds of ladybugs on her arms, like elbow-length gloves. She dusted them off and they fell pitter-patter into the ferns. John wore them like a blanket until Allie gently dusted him with a fern. They camped that night in the ruin of a cottage by the side of the road. The west-facing side of the house had been swept by fire and collapsed, burying the living room and kitchen in charred sticks and burnt shingle. But the east-facing wing was mysteriously untouched. White siding, black shutters, blinds drawn behind the windows. They settled in what had once been a guest bedroom, where they found a queen bed, neatly made. A dried, withered bundle of white viburnum rested on the pillow. A former guest had written a message on the wall. The Crowther family stayed here on our way to see Martha Quinn, followed by a date from the previous fall. By the time they lost the daylight, John was shivering uncontrollably, and his body only relaxed when Harper curled against him under the quilt. He glowed with heat, and it wasn't dragon scale either. It scared her, the dry, steady blaze of his fever. She carefully put her ear to his chest, listening to his lungs, and heard a sound like someone pulling a boot out of mud. Pneumonia, then. Pneumonia all over again, and worse than before. Nick stretched out on John's other side. He had discovered a copy of the Peterson Field Guide to Birds on an end table and was leafing through the pages, studying the pictures by the light of one burning finger. "What are you thinking?" Harper asked him. "I'm wondering how many of these have gone extinct," Nick told her. The next day the fireman was gummy with sweat. "He's burning up," Renee said, putting her knuckles to his cheek. "Be funny if I cooked to death," he muttered, and they all jumped a little. He didn't speak again all day. 23. They splashed through a soupy, Dijon-colored fog, beneath trees festooned with streamers of dirty mist. They walked north into it, and by mid-morning the sun was no more than a faint brown disk, burning a rusty hole through the paw. It was impossible to see more than a few yards into the miasma. Harper spotted what she thought was a hulking motorcycle leaning against the ruin of a barbed wire fence. It turned out to be a dead cow, its blackened skin fissured to show the ripe, spoiled flesh beneath, its empty eye sockets buzzing with flies. Renee staggered past it, coughing, holding her throat, trying not to gag. It was the first and last time Harper heard anyone cough all day. Even the fireman's breathing was long and slow and regular. Although her eyes and nostrils burned, she might have been breathing fresh alpine air for all the roiling smoke bothered her. The idea occurred to her that they were breathing a poison, had crossed into an environment roughly as hospitable to human life as Venus. But it didn't drop them, and Harper turned that thought over in her mind. It was the dragon scale, of course, doing its thing. She had known for a while that it converted the toxins and smoke to oxygen. This, though, led to another notion, and she called for Allie to stop. Allie held up, flushed and filthy. Harper knelt beside the drag sled, unbuttoned John's shirt, and put her ear to his chest. She still heard a dry and gritty rasp she didn't like, but if it was no better, it was also no worse. He was smiling and, in sleep, almost looked like his old, calm, wry self. The smoke around them was as good as an oxygen tent. It wouldn't make his pneumonia go away. The best chance for him now was a course of antibiotics, but it might buy him time. In the early afternoon, though, they dragged him clear of the haze and went on beneath a clear, cloudless, hateful blue sky, the sun throwing blinding flashes off every piece of metal and every sooty fragment of glass. By the time they finally got off the road, John was worse than Harper had ever seen him. His fever returned, a sweat springing up on his cheeks and in his gray, depressed temples. His tongue kept flicking out of his mouth, looking swollen and colorless. His teeth chattered. He spoke to people who weren't there. "The Incas were right to worship the sun, Father," the fireman said to Father Story. "God is fire. Combustion is the one inarguable blessing. A tree, oil, coal, a man, a civilization, a soul, they've all got to burn sometime. The warmth made by their passing may be the salvation of others. The ultimate value of the Bible, or the Constitution, or any work of literature, really, is that they all burn very well, and for a while they keep back the cold." They settled in an airplane hangar beside a small private landing strip. The hangar, a blue metal building with a curved roof, didn't have any planes in it, but there was a black leather couch in one office. Harper decided they ought to bungee him down to it, so he didn't roll off in the night. As she was binding him down, his rolling, baffled eyes locked in on her face. "The truck. I saw the truck this afternoon. You ought to leave me. I'm slowing you down and the plow is coming." "There's no way," Harper said, and brushed his sweaty hair back from his brow. "I'm not going anywhere without you. It's you and me, babe." "You and me, babe," he repeated, and flashed a heartbreaking smile. "How about it?" After he drifted off into fitful slumber, they collected together by the open hangar doors. Allie broke up a bookshelf with a hammer, and Nick made a campfire from the shelves and piles of flight manuals. He ignited the whole mess with one pass of his burning right hand. Renee turned up Dasani's and dried pasta in a cupboard. Harper held a pot over the flames, waiting for the water to boil. Harper's hand extended straight into their cook fire, the blaze licking around her knuckles. Once you had mastered dragon scale, you could skip the oven mitts. "If he dies," Allie said, "I quit. I don't care about Martha Quinn's island. I don't even like 80s music." The fire snapped and popped. "Here's the part where you promise me he won't die," Allie said. Harper didn't say a word for 10 minutes, and then all she told them was, "Pasta's done." 24. Late the next morning, the small party of pilgrims came around a bend and drifted to a shuffling, weary halt. What stopped them initially was a shock of color. On the left side of the road was the sort of scenery they were used to, blasted trees and a long slope of burnt sticks and ruin. But on the right was a gray-green forest of pine. The branches of the firs were caked in ash, but the trees beneath were healthy, undamaged, and the grass growing below them was rich and lush. Through the evergreens they saw a gleam of black water. A billboard stood on the green side of the road. Originally, it had featured an ad for Geico Insurance. A dainty little gecko suggested that 15 minutes or less could save a buck or two. Spray-painted directly under this helpful suggestion was a message in black. "New Main Free Zone. Infected, take gloves and coat. Stay on road, continue north, to Machias for Martha Quinn Isle. Infected, wear orange safety, garments at all time." An elderly pickup was parked alongside the billboard. The flatbed contained milk cartons crammed with bright orange work gloves. A pile of orange rain slickers had been heaped beside them. Nick climbed up to root around, lifted one of the slickers, and turned it so they could see. A biohazard symbol had been stenciled on the back in black.
What now? Renee asked.
Looks like we get dressed, Harper said. Will you be a Hun and find me a coat? I don't want to try and climb up there.
10 minutes later, they walked on, all of them in the orange slickers and orange gloves that marked them as sick. They hadn't tried to pull a coat on the fireman, had only tossed one over his chest.
The pond they had glimpsed through the trees turned out to be a nasty body of water indeed. Masses of dead fish rotted on the stones at the edge of the water, and the shallows were hidden beneath a floating blanket of ash, although the center of the little pool was clear and black. There were a few undamaged and empty cottages built alongside the water, from the days before there were setback rules on construction. Notices had been nailed to the front doors, above more black biohazard symbols. Hang on, Harper said, and left them in the road. She climbed the steps of the first cottage and read the notice. This house has been designated a temporary overnight shelter for those infected with Draco Incendia Trichophyton, a.k.a. Dragon Scale. If you are healthy, do not enter. Do not drink the water or use the toilets. There is bottled water in the fridge and canned goods. Do not take more than you need. There is absolutely no squatting. Visitors must depart within 12 hours. This residence is monitored by local law enforcement. Wear your orange safety garments at all time. Infected found not wearing clothing that marks them as sick will be considered hostile and may be shot. You are 131 miles from Machias, where you may be provided with transport to the Free Wolf Island DIT care unit. Our prayers are with you.
What's it say? Allie shouted. It says we can stay here overnight if we need to, Harper said.
But she already knew they weren't going to. It was too early in the day to stop. She let herself in, pushing back the door and stepping into the front hall. The cottage had a pipe smoke and dusty book smell that Harper associated with the aged. The phone on the wall had a rotary dial. Harper found her way to a kitchen with a view of the pond. A 1950s-era cold-spot refrigerator the color of a banana milkshake stood against one wall. A picture of Smokey the Bear in a rustic wooden frame hung next to the back screen door.
Only you can prevent forest fires.
The light switches didn't work. She peeked into the fridge and found pallets of room-temperature bottled water. The bathroom was as dark as a closet, and Harper had to fumble around for a while before she found the catch on the medicine cabinet. When she came out of the lake house 5 minutes later, Harper had a case of water under her left arm and a bottle of Bayer aspirin in her right hand. She squatted on the flagstone path and used a rock to crush 4 aspirin tablets into a fine powder. She spoon-fed the smashed pills to John, mixed in with little sips of water.
"Will that make him better?" Allie asked.
"It'll bring down his fever," Harper said.
"For a while," she thought.
If they didn't get antibiotics into him soon, all the aspirin in the world wouldn't keep his infected respiratory system going. He'd suffocate on his own fluids.
"Chim-chim-chiri," John muttered. "Chim-chim-chiruk. Here comes Jacob in his truck. Chim-chim-chiree, chim-chim-chiraw. Desolation's plow sweeps away all."
Harper kissed his sweaty, damp cheek, stood, and nodded to Allie. Allie bent and took the handles of the ladder.
"Let's go," Harper said.
25. They left the lake behind and soon crossed back into another burn zone. Low clouds of smoke smothered the sky, and they were hot and sticky in their slickers. A wind came in spasms, blowing grit. Harper had ash in her mouth, ash in her eyes. Allie collected ash in her long eyelashes and eyebrows and short, bristly hair. With her pink, dust-irritated eyes, she very much looked like an albino. When they stopped to rest, Harper took John's pulse. It was shallow and erratic. She crushed 4 more aspirin and force-fed them to him. Late in the afternoon, they came over a hill and looked down into more green, and this time it was on both sides of the road. On the right were swaying evergreens. On the left was a meadow of russet straw, bordered by blueberry bushes that were months from bearing fruit. A mile away they saw a white farmhouse, a barn, a gleaming steel silo. As they neared the farmhouse, Harper saw a woman standing in the dooryard, shading her eyes with one hand and peering back at them. A screen door slapped shut. A dog barked. They arrived at a fence of stripped, shining logs, with the farm buildings on the other side. A black retriever ran back and forth on a chain, flinging himself in their general direction and barking without cessation. His eyes shone with a jolly lunacy. A white bedsheet hung over the fence, one corner flapping in the breeze. Words had been written on it in Sharpie. "We are healthy. Please go on. Machias, 126 miles. God love and keep you. Help ahead." "These fucking people," Allie whispered. "These fucking people might have children," Harper said, "and maybe they don't want them to burn to death." "Burn to death?" John Rookwood shouted, cawing like a crow. He began to hack, a dry, wrenching cough, twisting violently on his stretcher. The woman continued to watch them from her front step. She looked like she had walked out of another century, in her ankle-length dress and blue denim blouse, a kerchief holding back her graying brown hair. Paper cups had been set along the fence post. They contained what looked like orange Gatorade. Nick picked it up, sniffed at it, glanced at Harper for permission. She nodded that it was all right to drink. "What if it's poison?" Allie asked. "There's easier ways to kill us," Harper said. "They could just shoot us. Who wants to bet that man watching from the second floor has a gun?" Allie darted a surprised look back at the farmhouse. A lantern-jawed man with raven-black hair, graying at the temples, swept back from his high brow, regarded them from a window above and to the right of the front door. His gaze was dispassionate and unblinking. Sniper eyes. The woman watched them drink, but didn't speak. Harper thought the orange stuff might be tang. Whatever it was sweet and clean and made her feel almost human. "Thank you," Harper said. The woman nodded. Harper was about to go on, then paused and leaned over the fence. "Our friend is sick, very sick. He needs antibiotics. Do you have antibiotics?" The woman's forehead wrinkled in thought. She looked at the fireman, strapped to the travois, and back at Harper. She took a step toward the fence and opened her mouth to speak, and the window on the second floor banged open. "Keep walking," the man called. And Harper was right. He had a rifle, although he didn't point it at them, just cradled it to his chest. "You take one step our side of the fence, you won't take another. There's a place for people like you up north." "One of them is sick," the woman called up. Her husband laughed. "All of them is sick." 26. All through the following morning, Harper was conscious of being observed, sometimes surreptitiously, sometimes openly. An old man in a wife-beater glared at them from behind the screen door of his cottage. Three small and nearly identical boys with running noses studied them from the window of their ranch house. Nick waved. They didn't wave back. Another time, a black car followed them, hanging about a quarter mile back, gravel grinding under its tires. It stopped when they stopped. And when they proceeded, it rolled on in their wake. Four men in it, two in front, two in back, men in flannel hunting coats and pork pie hats.
"I think they have guns," Renee said. "Do you think we're safe? No, don't answer that. They say there's no such thing as a stupid question, but I believe that qualifies. We haven't been safe in months."
The black car kept pace with them for over an hour before suddenly accelerating, then lurching off the highway onto a narrow side road, tires throwing stones. One of the passengers hurled an empty beer can out the window, but Harper wasn't sure he was throwing it at them. She didn't see any weapons, but as they took the corner, a fat, ruddy-faced man in the back seat made a pistol with his hand, pointed his finger at Nick, and pulled an imaginary trigger. Pow! Very late in the day, they reached the Bucksport trading post, which had the look of a former stable, with a hitching post out front and window frames of wormy, untreated pine. Antlers rose above the front door. A non-functional Coke machine from the 40s collected dust on the board porch. The dirt lot was empty,